Welcome to the Empaths Revolution podcast, the home of intersectional spirituality. Empaths Revolution is a platform dedicated to empowering, informing, and supporting empaths and other spiritually sensitive people via podcasts, expert guests, blogs, books, and personal one-to-one and group support. I'm your host, Harris Eddie Hill, and I'm non-binary, neurodivergent, and an intuitive empath. I'm a podcaster, best-selling author, NLP practitioner, and timeline therapist, and I'm pleased to bring you today's episode. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Empaths Revolution podcast, where today I am joined by Mark Silver. Hey Mark, how are you doing?
I'm delighted to be here. Yay.
Thank you so much for coming back. For those who haven't heard Mark before, he actually guested on my previous podcast, the Transsection podcast. We talked about socially forward business kind of thing, didn't we? And talked a little bit about your former work as a sort of advocate for bisexual rights and, you know, social justice and stuff. And today, in keeping with the podcast, I thought we could talk a little bit about kind of reclaiming your emotional sort of range as a man and also just as a human being, and what that's been like for you. And we could talk a bit about like spiritual business and stuff like that, because you and I are definitely on that wavelength, right?
Oh, so much. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm cool. Delighted to dive into those.
Nice. Well, I thought I would just start off because, you know, I support a lot of people who are very sensitive in one way or another. And it seems to me, Mark, that in a way there's always been a part of you, from what you've told me, that's like very attuned to your feelings. Did you ever go through a phase of suppressing that stuff, or do you think that you there was a core of you that was always quite like good with that?
No, I mean, oh, so painful. So as a young boy, and you know, I identify as cis, and I, you know, grew up crying very easily. I always cried very easily, and I was really teased and bullied a lot around that, to the point where I remember telling myself one day, I can't cry anymore. Like, I'm not crying anymore. And I remember like building up this wall between me and the world to shut that down. And it wasn't painful because it was numb. and I remember like I got into, punk rock, cause this was, I was born in 1968. I grew up in the 70s and 80s, outside Washington, DC in Maryland in the United States. And, in high school, I got into the punk scene there, and that was just wonderful and helpful and political and everything. But it was also like, it just further helped me kind of like wear a mask. And it took me years to reclaim my emotions. It was really hard. It was really hard. And I came out as bisexual in 1988. very cute boy helped with that when I was in college. I think I'm actually starting to blush. That's so hilarious. I haven't thought about him in quite a while, but what a sweetheart. But and it was in coming out and being around other men that were totally happy with emotions. And it took some years to take that wall down. And it was painstaking and it was difficult. And I felt like I was really unskillful with it for a long time. And I'm really happy with where I am now, you know, I'm in my mid 50s. I've had decades of practice at this point, but it's like, it was really hard. And, you know, I'm in a long-term monogamous relationship with a woman, with my wife, and the two boys that we have. It's like, I feel like it's been one of the most important things as a father, is just to let them see that I have the full range of emotions. Because it's just, man, toxic masculinity is such a terrible thing.
Do you feel quite free of it now? And like, how do you still navigate? I mean, there must be moments when you're kind of expressing yourself, feeling free of that, and then you must get challenged occasionally, maybe.
Well, I know that there's definitely times where I know that there's times in public where I kind of, my automatic reaction is to, like, you know, if I'm in a movie or something that moves me, that I'm like, oh, I don't want to be, you know, going from there into someplace else, you know, crying or looking, you know, it's still embedded in there, even though I do my best to kind of work around it. It still kind of pops up. And I also know that kind of paradoxically, I don't know if it's really a paradox, but on the other end of the spectrum, I'm still really unskillful with anger. Anger was something that I was always really scared of in myself. The first time, my wife grew up very differently than I did, in a lot of ways. And it was quite some time into our relationship. We've been together like 26 years, but it was quite some time into our relationship was like the first time I yelled at her. And she laughed in relief because anger didn't really throw her. And I cried. I scared myself so badly. And so I was a mess. And I still don't think I'm always that skillful with anger. I feel like, and by not skillful, I don't, you know, emotions are messy. They're just messy, and they're supposed to be messy, and it's okay that they're messy. But the whole thing over the last couple of years with COVID and with a lot of different stressors in our lives, we've been snapping at each other a little more than we ever have. I mean, we've never really gotten into conflict in our relationship a lot, and yet we've had some really hard conversations lately, and I can feel how I'm just unskillful with anger. Like it's something that I'm no longer scared of it. Like, I'm not scared of it anymore. I'm not scared. People can hit me with all kinds of anger and it doesn't shake me. But in expressing it, I don't know if I even have the words. It's interesting that you ask me this because it's so, it's fresh, and I don't have like an easy pat answer.
Yeah.
Like things that I've worked with for many years.
Yeah,
like tears and sadness and grief, I'm like, that's easy. But it's like the anger piece. It's like, how do you walk with anger in a way that is honoring to the anger, because it's an emotion, but doesn't hurt someone? Mm. You know, and you know that isn't violent towards someone. And it's something that I feel like I still walk with. It's something I feel like I'm really examining lately in myself.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that it would be your thing, but the thing that helped me make friends with my anger was boxing. And I've talked about it before, but I, similarly to you, or kind of how you've described you used to feel, I was really scared about who I was when I was angry. I didn't know that version of myself. And I was like, can I trust myself not to do the wrong thing? Or can I trust myself to like have self-control? Can I trust myself to not say something that I regret? And I actually ended up not only knowing that I could trust myself in all of that, but also that I quite enjoyed it. So, you know, I never seek out to be angry, and it's never like, it's never the first stop that I get to. I'll try lots of things. I'll try communicating, setting a boundary, withdrawing, and all of that stuff. But on the occasions that I am righteously angry, I still don't say anything I regret, but I also really enjoy it. And I think that's such a weird thing to say, but it's the truth.
Well, there's a kind of an unleashed quality to anger. You know, it's like there's no, I think for those of us that, you know, in all the different ways feel like we've had to, wow, strong emotions coming up in this moment. Whew. Just feel tears up in my eyes, you know, have had to shut ourselves down or hide ourselves in some way. It's really something to feel unleashed, you know, to feel that sense of freedom. And anger, I think, has a unique flavor of that particular thing. And, I don't think I would take up boxing, but I did fencing when I was sort of, and I actually did like medieval battle. Like we did stuff like this in high school, hitting each other with foam swords. And cool. It was cool. It was really fun. Before it was cool, it was fun. But I would love. I guess they call it LARP. I guess the kids call it LARPing these days. before the term was, I got gray in my beard. I'm legit. So anyway, it's. But to find some way of being able to express it. The funny thing is about anger is one of the things that I've noticed is that expressing anger, like anger, and this comes from my spiritual studies as well, that anger has a fiery quality that can feed on itself. Like if we're not careful, like I find that with grief or sadness or fear, like those tend to spend themselves. Whereas I feel like anger has a way of feeding on itself, and it doesn't burn out as quickly if you just give it free rein. Yeah. And it feels more dangerous in that way. And does that yeah. jive with your experience?
Yeah, I think you've got to have the tools to actually address it and kind of embrace it and face it. I spoke to a friend recently and he said, I asked him how things were going and he's kind of got his life together, but then went through quite a unpleasant experience. And it sounds like it's left him with a bit of trauma. And he said, I'm angry all the time and I don't know what to do with it. And I said, you need to go make friends with that anger. That's a part of you that really loves you. And he was like, oh my God, I never thought of that.
It's beautiful.
And I was like, it's got something to say. It's a really important part of you. So yeah, I think if it's not managed, then it can become a problem. I've met people with anger issues and ongoing problems. And I think I was always scared of that happening to me. If I allowed anger to happen or acknowledged it or let it express itself, I was like, oh, I don't know what it's going to do. But no, I think if you, providing you haven't got like an existing anger issue, I think it's quite an empowering part. It can be an empowering part of you if you're able to like embrace it and really accept it as part of you. I mean, generally, like it doesn't happen with me very often and I'll be in the moment, but because I've got no resistance to it, I can express it and say what I need to say, and then I walk away and calm down, and then that's it, and it's done. It doesn't linger.
Right. Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
But I appreciate where you're coming from. I think nobody teaches us, oh, this is a really good way to be angry.
Right.
Just like, yeah, good luck with that, or don't do it. And you're like, oh.
Okay. yeah.
Thanks.
that's helpful. Anyway.
Yeah. So, going off the back of this conversation around kind of like, you know, emotional, I don't know, skills, I suppose. Do you see a lot of this and particularly toxic masculinity as well? Do you see this coming up a lot in your sort of business coaching and with clients? And do you think it gets in the way?
You know, the funny thing is that almost anything one does with self-development or transformational work or spiritual work, that if you're not explicitly using certain kind of language to market to men, you get almost entirely women or people who are more in touch with, you know, their gender identity in a way that it's, so I have very few men in art of business. There's just very few men there. And the men who show up, like one of them, like he helps men with porn addiction. And he's like way, like he's, you know, like we're pretty self-aware men. And so it doesn't really come up. I don't really see, thank goodness, you know, like I'm grateful. Like it doesn't show up in our space a lot. And I think that, So I'm just, I'm just grateful that that's not something I'd have to deal with. Cause you know, we wouldn't tolerate abusive activity in any way whatsoever.
No, for sure. But I do think like even with the most well-meaning people, they might still be unpacking some of that or like not consciously aware of something.
Sure. Yeah. I haven't seen anything like that in a very long time. Thank goodness.
I guess the opposite question to that is, do you think that emotional intelligence plays a big part in your business and also attracting clients?
I think it does. I think that there's, I haven't really thought about it in this, from this perspective, but I think because we are so forward and clear in who we are and who we're talking to, I think there's a lot of self-select, you know, people self-select in, and, you know, we're very explicitly about a certain kind of intersection of social justice and spiritual work and business development. And I'm, you know, very visible as both Muslim and bisexual and in a relationship with a woman. You know, there's all these identities that it's like, it takes a certain kind of man, I think, to kind of thread those pieces, you know, in our culture. You know, it shouldn't make a difference at all, obviously, but it unfortunately does. And so the men who show up tend to be really, just loves. Like they're just dear hearts, you know.
I love that. So live really outwardly living your principles helps to weed out all the wrong people, I suppose.
Well, I think it does. And I think it's I'm sure it doesn't hurt that I'm a white middle-aged man. You know, it's like there's also certain kinds of things, like certain kinds of crap I'm just not going to catch. You know, I'm in my sovereignty, I'm in my power, I'm in a phase of my life where I just don't get a lot, you know, like the combination of how I walk in the world and who I am. I think I just don't get a lot of crap because I'm not the kind of person that people give crap to, you know? And I'm sure if I looked different or if I were in a different phase in my life, there would be the potential for a lot more coming at me.
Yeah, that's fair enough. So I suppose in a way you're sort of living in a very aligned way, like your clients get you, you know, you're yourself, you're, you know, you're not sort of 20 and nervous about being yourself anymore. Do you ever look at sort of, you know, the big gurus or the big coaches with the big platforms and feel that there's kind of parts that they're missing in terms of like their emotional range or their spirituality or anything like that?
Yeah. God forgive me. I don't, it's not like I'm sitting around in judgment on people, but I do see that, you know, I think it's certain people, you know, sometimes it's a function of age, and not to be ageist, but there is something that I found that just comes with maturity, with just having decades of life under your belt. There's, you know, hopefully a certain maturity that if one takes the opportunity to develop it over time, that it's there. And I do see people they're doing great, they're doing fine. And I can see how they're going to have a more like a like a different center of gravity in themselves as they grow into themselves a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely, I mean, so the challenge is that to have a large platform, often the best, not the best way, I wouldn't say the best, but one way to do it that is often done is to create a cult of personality around yourself. You know, you look at people, I'll use someone like Tony Robbins, I use him as an example for of this quite, you know, it's like, I think that so much of what he's doing is really not okay. And really, anyway, we won't spend a whole time doing a whole critique of Tony Robbins' work, but it's like, there is, at least, and I've never met the guy in person, but I'm like, I want to see you in yourself. Like, I want to see him in his heart and deeper in himself, rather than like, it feels like he lives at a level that I don't think we're getting the fullness of who he is there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I there's every human being is made up of many, you know, we're all different. We all have different uniqueness to us. And inevitably in every human being, there's a tenderness and a humility that is at the heart of how we connect to the greater whole. And even when we show up as really strong, that tenderness, that sincerity, that humility is, I think, so precious and important in every human being. And it's what I hope to see or have some sense of in folks. And I can see people sometimes thrown out of their center when they're reaching for something bigger. Mm-hmm. And then their messages, I was having a conversation with somebody on my team recently. We were looking at some emails from somebody and we're like, yeah, you can feel that something's off. With the email, you can feel that there's something that's not sitting right. And there's something that's not 100% true. It's not that they're lying, but that they don't have hold of some deeper sense of either humility or sincerity that I think it's hard. It's hard because it's hard to, you know, you can't diagnose without actually sitting down and knowing the other person's truth. I can't know. Am I projecting? Maybe I'm projecting. Who knows? But because other people had the same sense that I had and articulated it in a similar way, it's not necessary. You don't have to grow your business that way.
Yeah. And I imagine that it's really exhausting as well to be coming from such a place of showmanship and, you know, and also talking more about Tony Robbins, and, you know, there's no judgment from me. I just tend to make observations, but, you know, at his age, he's worked his body very hard. He's had heart attacks and stuff, I think, you know, and I guess from my kind of social justice perspective, I always find it interesting that he has this goal of like feeding, like giving a million meals to impoverished Americans, but there's no discussion around changing the system so that poverty doesn't exist in the first place, which I find really odd. And to me, that's just an exercise of ego, or that's kind of like a surface level gesture,
right?
And, you know, I feel like by the time any human has got some significant level of influence and voice and platform, there should be a lot more calls to changing systems and talking about inequality far more than there tends to be.
I think I'm glad that you went there, because I was reaching for something else, but that context that you brought in, I think is Exactly right. I think that there's still, you know, there's still a sense of that it's centered on the self. And until, and if you're centered on the self, then it's hard to see systemic issues. It's hard to see, like, if there's not a sense of a we-ness, if it's only me, then that's that, oh, I'm the actor and anybody can do whatever what I can do. By actor, I don't mean film actor. I mean the one who is taking action. And then you're disconnected from the reality that there is no individuality. Like, we all are connected and there is this sense of collectiveness that we have to pay attention to. Like, it's so painful, you know, to look at people who are hungry and to think I can feed them, as opposed to why are they hungry? Like, why don't they have food? Yes. Yes.
What's the cat's name? Oh.
This is Ori, who is short for orange swirl.
he's beautiful.
Yeah, he is. He is. He's how much? 7 months? 8 months now? So, yeah.
It's my dream. It's my dream to have an orange cat one day.
We're living your dream.
Oh, it's lovely.
It's coming to you. Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you looking to get your energy in order, spring clean your life, and manifest things you actually want? My Align Your Life Starter Pack has helped people to relieve insomnia, anxiety, to become grounded, and to manifest exciting new things, as well as cut energetic cords with people who are draining their energy. And as a bonus, it's designed with non-visual and neurodivergent people in mind, so it's more accessible than most things currently on the market. Affordable and instantly downloadable, you can find it at mooksharrishill.com/mybl. Align your life, reclaim your power. So if you, Mark, could get in front of a lot of these kind of, you know, really high up kind of business influencer type, you know, celebrities or whatever, what would be the, and they were open and they were like, you know, we want to up our game. What do you think is like the main thing that you'd want to communicate to them?
Stop upping the game. You know, like, that's the problem. I, you know, there's a prayer in Sufism, in Islam and Sufism, that says, you know, oh Allah, please make me so that you are content with me, and make me so that I am content with you. And there's this sense of spiritual state called Ridha, meaning contentment, that it's not a stagnancy, and it's not a, oh, we can't, you know, if something's wrong, you know, if somebody's in pain or hurting, but there's like this deep contentment, like the restless search for more. I mean, the idea that, it, you know, someone, yeah, I think that it's hard, of course, to answer a question in the general, like you're asking, because it would be so unique to the person and what they're facing and what their heart's needing and what is there. And in general, when I've worked with people who are extremely successful and running successful companies and, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, you know, it's like when I work with people like that, often the emphasis is on a sense of surrender and of letting go of the word success and finding a different relationship with life. Because what it has often taken to get there has been a lot of work that is exhausting and not always in alignment. Mm-hmm. And not always, but sometimes involves some betrayals of something deep inside. And so there's often a working with that of the of the of the surrender of like, what is it that your heart really wants? Like, what is it? And it's not even what your heart wants. Like when I ask a question like that, it has nothing to do with normal desires, which are fine. You know, I'm fasting for Ramadan and I'm very much desiring dinner, even though it's several hours off. These kinds of things are fine, obviously, but it's almost the question of like, where are you supposed to be? Where are you being placed? What's being asked of you? And asking that in a very sincere way and really listening, I think is really the pathway for most of us. And I think it's the pathway of for a lot of these folks who have found themselves in some position where they hold a certain amount of power or wealth. And what's being asked of you here? You know, there's something that's being asked of you that's not about what you want. And and it's such a beautiful place when people arrive there because it opens everything up.
Yeah, 100%. I was in an LGBTQ plus business group, and the other day someone had posted a picture of Jeff Bezos in an office in 1999, and it said, the caption was something like, you know, he was struggling with this, that and the other, and you know, sort of like 23 years later he's a billionaire, one of the richest men in the world, like don't give up. And I was like, oh no. You know, I always find it interesting that this kind of extreme capitalism, when it intersects with the sort of queer community, I'm like, oh dear. And I just sort of made the point, I was like, I said, yeah, I mean, I think the sentiment of don't give up is it's a great thing to say to people, especially if they're struggling. But I think that we could maybe look at role models who haven't exploited thousands, if not millions of people to get to where he is. And then, you know, kind of not made the impact on humanity and the earth that a lot of us would hope that we would make had we ever reached that situation. But of course, and I made the point, there was a whole conversation, I made the point that a lot of us would never reach that position because we wouldn't be prepared to do to other people what he has done to get there. So actually for a lot of the, you know, the more, I don't want to say average of us, but I guess in a statistical sense, a lot of us wouldn't be prepared to kind of offer. I could never give a worker a 0-hour contract, not even one, let alone all of them.
Right.
And, you know, I think about particularly, I'm not a great political thinker. I don't really like the idea of politics because to me it flies in the face of connection in the first place. But, you know, I guess in terms of words that would describe what I'm into, I think about business and I think, you know, if again, at some point I have a business and have a team of people, I would probably want to approach it with a more anarchistic sense that there's no hierarchy and everyone gets paid the same. And, you know, I'd make sure that everyone's sort of got their medical cover if they need it, all of that kind of thing, unlimited time off and fully paid and things like that. I guess for you, there's going to be a lot of similar thoughts about sort of how to spiritually and ethically run a business. Do you want to share some of your insights? Yeah.
Well, it is. I mean, and I think that these are really good questions to ask. You know, one of the things that was a strange thing for me to discover on my journey as a business owner, and we have a team. We have a small team because we have what we want, but it's like, is that people, the people who work for us want a hierarchy because they don't want to be running a business. Like that's not what they want to do. They want to do something else. In fact, we had someone who worked for us for 5 years, really happily, was delighted. And it was time for her to, she was running her own business. She's coach and doing other things, and she's moved on recently. Teresa Bittner, fantastic person, lovely, amazing help for us. And she's like, she doesn't she didn't want to be making owner level decisions. Like she'd like, that's not where she wanted to put her energy. Like the amount of time that it takes to just kind of like sit and be with a business to kind of discern direction and things like that. You know, it's just interesting. Like sometimes it's okay to have a job that is ethical and you do good work, but it's not your main focus. Like there's a part of the problem, of course, in trying to develop a business inside of capitalism like this is that there's not really ever been a society like this. And even in previous mercantile societies, and there's been, you know, quite a few looking a lot of different ways, money didn't enter into every single thing. Like even in the United States, if you go back 100, 150 years, money was used way less because so much more was just found in community. You know, it's like you lived with extended family, people farmed, and sure, you did still buy things. Not everybody was just like making everything themselves. There was always some kind of trade because it's ridiculous to have one family do everything for themselves, you know? And often people were doing things communally, right? It's like shared grazing land or shared garden plots and so when we think about creating a business, there's not an ideal form, yeah. Right? It's like, it's got to meet the needs of the people that are involved with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know people that are involved in collectives that are very similar to what you described. And that's another wonderful model, and you didn't say it was the only model. It said, you said very clearly that it was what you would want to do.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to kind of contemplate that there's just room for so many different models.
Yeah.
But the one model that there shouldn't be is the Jeff Bezos model, where the essence of the business itself is destructive, and the relationship with the workers is destructive, and there's just no sense of care.
Yeah. I think we talked in our first interview on the Transsection podcast about what we think an ideal society would look like and how that would work. Mm-hmm. And you said something really interesting then about how, you know, I don't know, I'm paraphrasing. I don't know that you put it in exactly these terms, but you said something along the lines of trying to come up with another idea that's another one size fits all is just the same problem again and again. Like, you know, from a societal mm-hmm. point of view, to try and create societies everywhere that follow a different model is creating the same problem again, because even from like an agricultural perspective, some people live in places where they can't farm anything.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the time they do survive on sort of local wildlife because they don't have easy access to plants, fruits, vegetables and grains and stuff. So, I guess from a business perspective, because every system is a sort of smaller or bigger version of something else. Right. And, it's the same with business. You know, I've met people and I've had like assistants over the time where they wouldn't want all of that responsibility. They'd want to know that they were doing a certain number of hours for a certain pay each week. And they didn't want to think about it any more than that and didn't want to be involved. But I guess it's a collaborative thing, right? You want to kind of find out from people how much they want to be involved and what they want out of it.
Well, and it's so interesting too, because we're not raised like this, right? We don't have the skills. You know, we were talking before about not having, you know, nobody teaches you about anger. Nobody teaches you how to operate collectively. Nobody teaches you how to operate collaboratively. And so, you know, I haven't done it, but I've had friends who have started businesses that they intended to run very collaboratively. But the people who came to work for them and with them wanted the benefits of the collaboration, but wouldn't put in the work. And it ended up being a disastrous thing for the person who was organizing it, because they were really taken advantage of, you know. And I don't think anybody did that intentionally. I think people are just, you know, whenever we've hired people at Heart of Business, it usually takes them somewhere between 6 and 12 months to get that it's not a toxic workplace. You know, that they don't have to defend themselves, that when they make a mistake, that it's celebrated, because mistakes are mean that they're exercising their creativity and sovereignty in their role, that that they really can take time off and as much as they need. Like if they're sick, they're sick. They're not going to like run out of sick days, you know. It's like it's but it takes a long time for them to figure that out. And that we really mean that, because a lot of people talk a good game but don't follow through with it, you know, or they have their own reactions, or when it actually comes time to it, they kind of freeze up, you know. I don't want to always ascribe people as lying or nefarious in some way. Sometimes they're just, you know, dysfunctional in some way. It's like, it can be scary. It's like you're facing payroll and the sales haven't been good enough, and then people want to take time off, and then you're paying them and they're not doing the work. Like I can understand people can, you know, have reactions. You know, but that, you know, but coming down on the workers is not addressing the right problem. But it's like, and so there's so much to learn. I've had long conversations with other friends about all of this. It's that we have lost so much about how to do healthy community, about how to do healthy, like what is, like the word, like we use the word community in ways that it has never historically been used. And I think that it's useful, you know. I mean, the queer community, it's really a useful word, you know, the small business community, the spiritual community, like these are useful ways to use it. But it doesn't mean people living in proximity, sharing a circumstance and coming together to work collaboratively with their environment to live in healthy relationship with each other. Like that's not how that word community is being used.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of grief about it, and I don't know, like there's not an easy answer to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. So, Mark, if people are listening who kind of want to either start a spiritually aligned business, or they want to kind of make their existing business more spiritually aligned, what are the common things that you help people with, or what would you tell them? What are the common pitfalls?
Yeah. So the first thing I want to say is that every business is already a spiritual business. Like spirituality is not separate from anything. It's just a matter of whether we're looking for it and looking to witness it. And to find, it's the question that I often have people ask is love available even here in the sales conversation? Is love available even here when I'm working on web copy or working on whatever I'm working on about my business? And so spiritually aligned, it really at the heart is, what kind of a relationship do we have? Do we have a relationship where we're seeing each aspect of the business and each aspect of the thing, of the people involved with the business, as expressions of the divine? Or are we consciously or unconsciously thinking that some aspect or some person is somehow outside of that reality? And I think that that's where really the pitfalls are, is that typically, especially for the small business owners that we work with, people think that, oh, the work that I do is really beautiful and sacred, and yet the business isn't. And that's often what we're really working with people is to, it's like, and we do that by getting into the nitty-gritty of it. It's like, okay, here's the elements of the sales conversation, for instance. Here's how you do it non-manipulatively in an engaged way. And here is the spiritual essence of each piece and where it comes from and what it can be and how to connect. And when people can see the beauty in each aspect of their business, then it becomes much easier to embrace and to walk with it in a much healthier way.
Mm. I love that. That's beautiful. If, like all small businesses or most of them, started to take on this much more mindful and sort of heart-centered approach to business, what changes do you think that that would make in the world or society in general?
Yeah. So for me, spirituality is not separate from social justice, because it has to do with our relationship with the world. And in our relationship with the world, like, one of the divine qualities is justice. And for us to carry justice and peace and love and strength and wisdom means that if we had spiritually aligned businesses, if we had justice aligned businesses, we would be, I think we're seeing aspects of that, at least in the United States. You know, the Great Resignation, I'm not sure if it's happening at the same rate in Europe or UK, but it's like people not willing to bear the cost of evil anymore, and willing to step away from it. And I'd be curious to see what happens, you know, if people had that, if people were really embedded in local communities and really embedded in spiritually aligned businesses, however you define spirituality, even if it's just a connection to love. And I don't mean just, because love is enough, certainly. I think that we would be less at effect of these large global corporations. You know, it's like we're privileged enough to be living where we are, and we know farmers, Amish farmers near us. What, another friend of ours lives on her parents' and works on her parents' dairy farm, and we have access to local food, we have access to local resources. A tree comes down in a storm, and I'm really privileged to live on land, but I know somebody with a local mill, you know, a portable mill, and so we can mill that tree up and use it. I don't have to go to a big box store and buy wood to do something with. It's like, as we become more aligned with these smaller businesses and more connected and more embedded in local communities, it's not that we have to do everything for ourselves. It's that we begin to know personally people who can help us, and we can help back. And then we're less dependent on Amazon. We're less dependent on the box stores. We're less dependent on the incredibly fragile network of supply that can break down in a moment's notice. And when we become less dependent on it, and we feed it less with our attention and our resources and our money, then it starts to die. Like, it can't help but start to die. Mm-hmm. So that's my hope.
Yeah, mine too. I love that. Do you think that some of this change would have to be legislated, or do you think that that's just never going to happen? Do you think it really is up to consumers in general?
There is no way that capitalism and a market economy is going to solve the problems. There is just no way. Like, individual action or even collective action is needed, but I think that part of the expression of collective will is local ordinances. You know, it's like, and that's why I'm not doing it myself, but I mean, I'm not involved with my local township yet. I mean, this is part of the crush of capitalism, like raising kids and running a business. Like, how do I find time to become engaged with local? But that's what's important. I was sitting the other day and reading through the budget for the township that we live in, and just reading through the budget. I'm like, half of the budget of the town goes to the police department. I'm like, really? Like, is that really necessary? Is that really necessary? And so I think that collective will can be expressed in really helpful ways, and ordinances and legislation, I think, is an important part in the system that we have, because anarchism, as much as I like aspects of it, I don't know how to get, I don't know how to transition to that in the, our current society. I feel like, what are ordinances and legislation but collective decisions, right? If collective decisions are made truly collectively, if we all had businesses and we were able to have the time and space to be engaged locally, then instead of, you know, as some friends of ours do, you know, work two jobs and have to drive a tremendous distance, and so they can't be involved in their local town, just there's just no time for it. But if people actually had the time and space to do that, then the ordinances would reflect our collective will a lot more closely.
Mm.
I don't think it's a utopia. There's always going to be power imbalances that need to be rectified and addressed and spoken to, but be a lot better than it is now, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the way we're living now really holds people and their time to ransom, I think. So we can't make these changes with any real effect. So it's difficult to know. It's sort of a chicken and an egg thing. And like you say, it's highly unlikely that there are going to be any governments coming along and saying, well, this is a bit too much capitalism now. You know, so it is up to us. But then it's like, well, if we have to kind of work to survive that much of our time at the same time as having our own connections, whether that's children or friends, partners, whatever. Yeah. Well, like when does that ever really happen? And it's
by design. Like it's by design. What was that company that the emails were released? Oh, yeah. In our local, I think the restaurant Applebee's, there were, I hope I have that right, because I don't want to get sued for, anyway, there's some restaurant, there were emails that came from senior management that said, oh, good thing that gas prices are going up, because that means that our employees will be hurting more. And so that means that we'll have more power over setting their schedules. They won't be able to argue with us as much. And it's like,
horrific.
It is horrific, and it is far more common than I think we know.
Yeah.
It's like these emails surfaced, but that doesn't mean that it's not happening 1,000 other places. So it's horrific. It's horrific. There is so much joy in this world, and there are so many people doing such good things. It is so important for us to not feel isolated, and to connect with each other, and to lean into one another, and be willing to ask for help, and be willing to try things, and to push against this extreme, what feels like inevitable, but is in actuality an extremely fragile system that is ready to fall just under its own weight,
yeah.
Never mind, you know, any collective action that people take.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard plenty of people who know better than me say that we're in late stage capitalism and these things, you know, it's not a great kind of prognosis at this point. It's always been my dream that whenever we elect or hire people into positions of power, that they should pass some kind of, I don't want to say psychological, but some kind of step, like an ethical and a morals test. And there should be some standards and things that we expect from our leaders, whether that's kind of small scale or large scale, so that, you know, they're not corruptible, they can't be bribed. And they've also got like more, you know, they're prioritizing the things that are like really important, like, you know, survival of the people they're responsible for, and not polluting the planet anymore, and treating people well.
I mean, Malcolm Gladwell on his revisionist history podcast a couple seasons ago, I forget exactly when, did a story on elections that were, this was in South America somewhere, I'm trying to remember. Anyway, elections where it was by lottery. Like if you were interested, you put your you put your name in. But there was no campaigning. There was no election. It was just lottery. Mm-hmm. And what they found was that many more people were interested when they found out that they didn't have to campaign, that it wasn't a personality parade. And that people, when they were selected by lottery, because you got a much more diverse group, people performed really well. Like they performed really well. And especially because there was no guarantee they were going to stay in office because it's a lottery, you know, like they can't do fundraising and campaign to stay in office. And I was really struck by that. There were a number of different examples where it showed up like, oh, this was effective over and over and over again.
Wow.
And I like the idea. I think we should try it.
Yeah, I like that. I've been watching, there's a new series out in the UK at the moment called, oh no, it's gone now. I think it's on, for the English people or whatever listening, it's on Channel 4. And it's called The Simpler Life. Mm. And there's an Amish family who've come over to the UK. They've got sort of like a plot of land with some sort of farmhouses. And then 24 English people have gone to live with them and tried for, I think, 3 months. And the idea is that they teach them their ways and, learn about collaboration and collective thinking and do every decision you make for the community. There's something that I really love about it. And what were we just talking about before that? I'm having a brain fart now.
Maybe it's Ramadan for you too.
I've got no excuse.
Lottery did legislate the elections right. By lottery.
Thank you for the reminding me. And they were talking about they often, every time they chair a meeting, they just do it by either by rota or they just draw a name out of a hat or something. Like there's no sort of like I'm the leader and this is my job. It's like everybody takes part and everybody kind of gets a say, and then everybody votes in each decision that they make for the community. And there was this real sense of like, not that people didn't have their roles, but I'm not suggesting that this is like a perfect solution to anything, but I just found it really interesting that there was kind of no egos involved. And even when there were two of the English women having a disagreement, they were raising their voices a bit to each other. And the wife, the Amish wife, got very upset. And she said, I can't imagine ever speaking to another human like this. And it wasn't even like, by our standards, right. It wasn't even that bad. And I was like, there's definitely something to this. And The English people couldn't get out of their mind that they couldn't use even a little bit of the community money to like buy a beer for the weekend. Or, one woman on there was like, well, I want to buy my kids cereal because, she's a picky eater. And at the moment she's only eating pasta and that's not very good. And I was like, well, cereal's not
right.
Slightly better, but, it was just fascinating to watch. And I felt a bit sad. I really felt like if I went and did, went and had an experience like that, I'd really hope to blend in as much as possible. And I almost wouldn't dare to kind of, fight to bring in my toxic and self-centered way of thinking.
Well, especially in a learning process like that. But there's always like, there's always two sides to that, right? It's like, if you look at the Amish communities, we know Amish people here, we see them every week because we buy from them and we've gotten to be friends with them, and lovely, lovely people. And, I don't think you or I could be out as ourselves in those communities.
No.
Like that sense of collectivity has the ups and downs, but there are pieces to learn. There's a book that I read some years ago called Better Off. And it's about a couple who went to live with Amish community for a year and the lessons they drew from that. And I thought that was really brilliant. So, So we are kind of in these topics that I don't feel like I'm an expert in. I have some opinions because I've read some books and done some thinking about it, but I'm like, my expertise is in, Sufism and business building, small business building, and you know, parenting young teenagers. I'm not an expert in parenting young teenagers, but
who is?
We're trying, but send help. But they're lovely. It's going well. We spent the last two nights watching WrestleMania. Anyway, I think that business has an important role to play in the healing of the world. And part of it is knowing the role that it has to play, which is not the entire role. Mm. Market-based solutions for everything is, I think, a terrible, terrible mistake. And there are certain things that shouldn't be involved with business and shouldn't be involved with money and the and that kind of an exchange. There are people who say, like, well, you're always selling, you know, and so everything is a sales conversation. And I'm like, frick off, that is totally not true. And you know, if I'm having a conversation with my family and we're trying to decide where we're going to eat, and I'm advocating for something, that's not a sales conversation. That is a rich conversation of relationship about, you know, of course I'm talking about food. I just feel my belly. I love Ramadan. And it's the third day and I'm still getting used to it. Anyway, there are things that what we've seen in late stage capitalism is that more and more and more things they've been trying to extract money and wealth out of it. You know, it's like childcare. You know, used to be that you lived in multi-generational homes, right? And childcare wasn't a thing. You just went out and who are the adults that were there took care of whatever, you know, it's like there was that kind of an arrangement. Or you lived in smaller communities and you had friends who could watch your kids, or, you know, or going back further, like in certain kinds of villages, there was collective care of the kids, you know, and if an adult had to do something, they could do it. You know, it's like, it wasn't that, but now we have to pay for, you know, people pay for childcare. And it's an expense that you then have to earn more money for to be able to pay for. And, you know, there's just, and it's become so commoditized. Our lives have become so commoditized. And the more that we can do without exchanging money, I think gets us back to a way that the world, you know, we're in a very unique place in human history. It's never been quite like this before. And I think it's really warped our sense of how we approach problem solving.
Yeah, I would massively agree. Only yesterday I was counseling a friend who has been having the same issue over and over again for really long enough now. And it's an area that I know literally nothing about. And I said, you need to go and talk to somebody who is an expert in this area that you need help in. I said, you can't keep having the same conversation with me repeatedly. You know, as much as I love somebody, that's not something I like doing anyway, after a while. And also I was like, you know, and apart from me, I don't really know who else she's really communicated with, and certainly not somebody who really knows about it. So you've got to get out there, man. And like, you know, talk to the right people. The right person will be able to tell you with, like, say something useful within half an hour. Mm-hmm. You know, like, but we've spent hours and hours chewing the fat over this and you've got no solution because I'm the wrong person. And yet, you know, and I feel like I'm often pointing out to people, including myself sometimes, you know, there's a whole world of people out there that you could be talking to who know lots about this, or, you know, can offer you a million and one different solutions for a problem. And there's a real sense of, like, I find, of people having their kind of, their, maybe if they're lucky, a small group of very close friends that they can confide in. But outside of that, there's not a lot of deep conversation going on of, like, I'm struggling with this. I don't know what to do about this. in a community sense.
Right.
You know, if we were in a village hall full of 150 people, all with different expertise, I guarantee like at least one of them will know what to do.
Right. Right. And if you live in that kind of environment and you know that many people, it doesn't even have to happen in that kind of a public space. You would just know to go who to ask. And yeah. when you have that kind of, and see, that's a habit. Like people are afraid even to ask for help because it feels so vulnerable. But if you have a habit of asking for help and people helping each other, I mean, that was one of the things that I thought was so interesting in that book, Better Off, in the Amish communities, is that they didn't see, like there was no such thing as just leisure time. Like free time, like, or social time. Like you didn't get and just hang out with people. What you did is you got together and worked together. And that was a social time. But because there were a bunch of people coming together to do a barn raising or putting up fences or plant or whatever, because you're doing it collectively, you can do it leisurely. Like you're not like one person rushing to get as much work done as you can before the sun goes down. It's like there's 20 of you and it's super easy to get 20. And then you have a good time doing it. You know, that's your social time. And we've recreated that some by, you know, friends have come over and helped us prepare our garden and to help work on our land. And, you know, we help them with other things. And like that's amazing social time. You know, and that's, yeah, I've there's so many different threads. And this is what I was saying before about like, we've lost the habit of, we've lost the skills, we've lost the knowledge and the wisdom of how to be in community together. And I think that it's really vital for us to relearn those skills and relearn those pieces, and we're doing the best we can in the sloppy, messy ways we can, but there's no elders to hand it down to us. So it's beautiful and nourishing, and it's painstaking, and it's, you know, difficult. Yeah. And all the things.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you. Mark, is there anything that you want to sort of promote today, or anything that you want to invite people to if they're called?
You know, we haven't talked a lot about business today. I don't want to try to sell anything. The way that I like to think about, you know, people are adults. If you resonate with who we are and where we're coming from, just come and check us out and get to know us. You know, we've got a bunch of free stuff on the website. If you have a small business that you're needing help with, you know, most business coaches are saying, and business trainers, if they're good, are basically saying the same thing. And so it's really about finding someone that you resonate with, that has the flavor or the angle that's really going to work for you. And so, yeah, come check out the website, heartofbusiness.com. We have a free assessment on there. There's a free stuff column. There's a work with us column. You know, there's a newsletter. People love our stuff, who love our stuff, and people who don't love our stuff don't love our stuff. So come see if it resonates, come check it out.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. Me again, you're the only person who's been back twice besides my previous co-host. So it's been...
I'm so delighted. Every time I get to spend time with you, I hope I can get across the ocean sometime, because I want to sit in a room with you sometime.
Likewise, when I can, I am planning to do a road trip around North America.
Oh yes,
because there's so many people that I need to see.
We have a guest suite waiting for you, and 15 acres, and come stay with us if you want.
Nice. What are you doing next week?
Well, I'm actually taking the boys to Comic-Con, but it's
sweet.
but yes,
one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Lovely. Mark, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Take care, love. Really appreciate being here.
Thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it and think someone you know might benefit from it, please do share it with them and leave me a review. If you'd like more resources and information, you can go to my website, muxharrishill.com, where you can also join my mailing list or Facebook group to stay up to date and in contact. You can also connect with me on social media at Empaths Revolution. The Empaths Revolution podcast was created and produced by your host, Harris Eddie Hill.